Imagine being a sitting U.S. senator, just an absolute titan within your party, backed by this massive national brand, and then you walk into your own state primary, only to find that, well, over 56% of the voters in your own party actively want someone else.
Yeah, that is, I mean, it's a completely terrifying scenario for any campaign manager.
Right. Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we are unpacking a really dense, highly confidential 2026 political strategy report on the Tennessee governor's race. And honestly, that 56% statistic, that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Oh, absolutely. It
Yeah.
really throws a wrench into this whole idea of the, safe incumbent. Because when you look at the raw mechanics detailed in this source material, you realize that modern campaigns at this level aren't just about kissing babies and shaking hands anymore.
Not at all.
We're going to look at the underlying math, the incredibly complex campaign finance plumbing, which is wild, and the geographic trenches that actually dictate who runs a state.
And just a quick heads up for you listening before we get too deep into this, we're going to be looking at some heavily polarized strategies today from both the right and the left. So, to be perfectly clear, neither of us is taking any political sides today.
Right, no endorsements here.
Exactly. We are not endorsing any viewpoints. Our goal is purely to act as impartial guides. We just want to pop the hood and show you the raw arithmetic and the legal mechanisms of how these campaigns are engineered, based entirely on the factual data in this report.
Yeah, we're just reading the blueprints, looking purely at the structural analytics of how a candidate takes a theoretical strategy and actually applies it to millions of voters.
So let's hit the board. The current governor of Tennessee, Bill Lee, is term limited. He's out.
Right.
That leaves a wide open executive seat for 2026. Fast forward to the primaries on August 6, and the field is finally locked for the November 3 general election.
Which brings us to the two major contenders.
Exactly. On the Republican side, we have Marsha Blackburn, who is the state's senior U.S. senator. And on the Democratic side, we have Jerry Green, a Memphis City Council member. So, for anyone studying political architecture, this race poses this brilliant question.
How does a candidate take a massive, established federal brand and force it into a state-level executive race?
Yes. And on the flip side, how does a local politician whose entire brand is built on, neighborhood-level problem-solving build a coalition big enough to challenge that national behemoth?
It's two completely contradictory approaches to voter persuasion.
It really is. Now, to understand the November 3rd battlefield they're walking onto, we really have to look at the ground they just fought over, specifically this incredibly bruising Republican primary that just wrapped up.
Right, because you can't understand the general election without understanding the primary.
Exactly. But before we hit the primary numbers, we need to talk about how drastically the baseline of Tennessee politics has shifted over the last couple of decades.
The historical context is everything here. I mean, if you look back to 2006, you had a Democratic governor, Phil Britson, who won re-election with nearly 69% of the statewide vote.
Which is wild to think about today.
It is. That means in 2006, massive amounts of conservative voters were completely comfortable crossing party lines to vote for a moderate Democrat for governor.
But I mean, ticket splitting like that is basically extinct now, isn't it?
Almost entirely.
Yeah.
I mean, over the last 20 years, state politics have just become completely nationalized. By the time we hit 2016, 2020, and 2024, Donald Trump was consistently clearing 60% in Tennessee.
Wow.
Yeah. And Marsha Blackburn herself, she won her 2024 Senate re-election with 63.8% of the vote.
Right.
So structurally, a Republican candidate today is walking onto a field with a massive built-in demographic advantage. The assumption is if you have an R next to your name in a statewide Tennessee race, you're basically starting on third base.
Which makes the results of this August 6 primary so jarring. Here's where it gets really interesting for you listening. You'd think a sitting senator in a state that red would just cruise through her primary unopposed,
You would think so.
but Blackburn won the Republican nomination with a plurality, not a majority. She took just 43.6% of the vote.
Which is about 311,328 votes, to be exact.
Right. She defeated U.S. Representative John Rose, who took 32.9%, and State Representative Monty Fritz, who took 23.5%. Wait, so you're telling me a sitting senator couldn't even break 50% in her own primary?
Yeah.
It's like winning a qualifying heat, but realizing more than half the stadium was actually cheering for the other runners. How is that 56.4% vote for other conservative candidates not a major vulnerability, like a five-alarm fire for her campaign?
But what's fascinating here is the arithmetic behind it. On paper, sure, it looks like a disaster. Over 56% of the primary electorate actively pulled the lever for a challenger. But you can't just copy and paste that 56% and call it a guaranteed protest vote for the general election.
Yeah.
You have to look at the mechanics of this specific primary. All three of these candidates were running on a heavily pro-Trump conservative platform.
Oh, so they weren't fighting over ideology.
Exactly. They were fighting over authenticity, regional loyalty, and tone.
Got it. So they aren't disagreeing on where the car is going. They are just arguing violently over who should be allowed to drive it.
That's a really good way to put it.
Yep.
Plus, we have to factor in the sheer volume of cash. I mean, John Rose poured roughly $13 million of his own personal wealth into this primary.
$13 million just of his own money.
Yep. That kind of localized spending, especially combined with his deep ties to Middle Tennessee, is going to fracture any electorate. So the 43.6% shows Blackburn survived an incredibly expensive, well-funded intra-party challenge.
Okay, but surviving isn't the same as uniting. The strategy report we're looking at explicitly notes that this primary vulnerability leaves her with a massive task for November voter-level consolidation. And doing that in a midterm environment seems mathematically terrifying.
Midterms are an entirely different beast. A presidential election year naturally draws out casual voters.
Yeah.
You know, people who only vote when the White House is on a line.
Right, the surge voters.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But a midterm year, like 2026, relies much more on habitual, highly engaged party voters. You cannot just assume the same massive conservative turnout that showed up in 2024 will automatically show up in 2026.
So getting those frustrated Rose and Fritz voters to actually show up and vote for her is an open question.
A completely unmeasured question right now.
Because she has this fractured base and she needs to patch it up immediately. And according to the report, her campaign strategy relied on the ultimate currency of modern GOP politics to do that. Which is, of course, Donald Trump.
Oh, absolutely.
But the timeline of how they deployed him is what really caught my eye.
The timeline is a masterclass in political maneuvering.
Let's lay this out for the listener. During the actual primary, Donald Trump did not formally endorse Marsha Blackburn. He completely stayed out of it.
Silent.
Right. Yet, if you watched Blackburn's campaign ads during that time, she aggressively used his imagery. She used old audio clips of him praising her, and she heavily utilized explicit America First language.
She leaned into the association as hard as possible.
Exactly, without having the official signed stamp of approval. Then, on August 7, literally the morning after the primary ended, Trump issues a formal, complete, and total endorsement of Blackburn for the general election.
And the timing tells the whole story. By Trump staying neutral during the primary, he prevented a situation where he might alienate the voters who supported John Rose or Marty Fritz.
Because they're all his voters, too.
Exactly. Remember, John Rose was actually running a campaign arguing that he was the more authentic, confrontational MAGGA candidate. If Trump picks a favorite in July, he splits his own fan base in Tennessee.
So Trump stays out to protect his own brand, but Blackburn borrows his aesthetic anyway. And, you know, for anyone listening, this is a concept that goes way beyond politics.
Oh, for sure.
Like, if you manage a corporate brand or you're trying to launch a startup, take notes. This is a masterclass in strategic ambiguity. You borrow the momentum and the halo effect of a massive influencer or an endorsement without risking the backlash of a formal alliance.
Right. You get the vibe without the signature.
Yes. And then, the absolute second you secure your position, in this case, winning the primary, you drop the official endorsement to crush any lingering dissent.
It instantly changes the psychology of the race.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the morning of August 7, the narrative shifts from an internal party civil war to a unified front. It frames the general election as a party versus party race. Trump's endorsement acts as the bridge to pull that fractured 56% back into the fold.
But she still had to survive John Rose dropping $13 million just to get to that bridge. And fighting off that kind of personal wealth requires serious cash.
Very serious cash.
Which brings us to the campaign finance plumbing. And okay, let's unpack this because this is where the mechanics get incredibly opaque. We hear terms like PACs and super PACs all the time, but the legal firewalls between them are what make this next part so wild.
The campaign finance mechanisms outlined in this report are incredibly complex.
Yeah.
Mostly because they are navigating conflicting state and federal laws.
Right. Before we get into this $4.8 million workaround maze, let's just clearly define what we mean by an independent expenditure group or a PAC, because this entire strategy hinges on this definition.
Go for it.
Legally, a candidate has their official campaign committee. That's one bucket. But a PAC is a completely separate entity. They can raise massive amounts of money, but the absolute golden rule is they cannot coordinate with the candidate, right?
Correct. The legal firewall is incredibly strict. An independent PAC cannot share a strategy memo, they cannot text the candidate to ask what kind of ad to run, and they cannot coordinate messaging in any way. They must operate entirely independently.
Okay, so keep that firewall in mind as we look at this sequence of events based on public records. Tennessee state law heavily regulates how much a candidate can raise, and crucially, it completely bars a candidate from taking money from their federal Senate campaign account and dumping it directly into a state gubernatorial race.
Right. You can't just move it from bucket A to bucket B.
But on May 8, Blackburn's federal Senate committee gave $4.8 million to a federal PAC called the Club for Growth Action.
Which, just to be clear, is perfectly legal. It's a federal-to-federal transfer.
Okay, then. In June and July, a group called the School Freedom Fund transferred $4.81 million to a state-level PAC called the Tennessee Freedom Fund.
Following so far.
And then that state PAC immediately turned around and spent $4.81 million backing Blackburn in her state primary.
Yeah, the numbers line up almost down to the exact dollar.
It's like traveling internationally. It's like moving money through three different currency exchanges, you know, paying a tiny fee at each one so that when it finally pops out of the ATM in the country you're visiting, it's the exact local coin you need.
That's a perfect way to look at it.
Like, you didn't directly bring your home currency into the cafe, but the purchasing power got there anyway?
That is a highly accurate mechanical analogy, and we had to be very precise about the legal distinctions the report anchors on here.
Because it sounds sketchy to a normal person.
It does. Third-party observers, including campaign finance watchdogs like Open Secrets, they looked at this plumbing and called it an apparent workaround. There was even reporting that some of these PACs shared officers and a Washington, D.C. address.
Wow. Which obviously invites scrutiny. That completely strains the idea of an independent firewall.
It strains the optics, certainly.
Yeah.
But if we connect this to the bigger picture, as of late August, the report is very clear. No legal violation has been confirmed by the Tennessee Registry of Election Finance.
So they successfully threaded the legal needle.
Exactly. Federal law didn't prohibit the initial donation, and state law doesn't prohibit a state PAC from spending money independently.
But my question is, why go through this elaborate maze? I mean, aside from bypassing contribution limits, why not just focus all your energy on raising state money directly for the official campaign?
It's about the division of labor. This is a fundamental strategy in modern campaigns. The separation allows the PACs to do the dirty work.
Whoa, okay.
The Tennessee Freedom Fund can spend millions running harsh, negative attack ads against a primary challenger like John Rose. They can drag him through the mud. Meanwhile, the official Blackburn campaign, the one with her voice at the end saying, "I approve this message," gets to keep its hands completely clean.
So she gets to just run Posland ads about her biography, her record, and her ties to Trump.
Precisely. She legally insulates herself while outsourcing the heavy negative contrast work. The candidate gets to stay in the light while the PACs fight in the mud. It protects the frontrunner's positive identity, which she desperately needs intact for November.
Okay, so she has the legal firewall. She has the pay Hess money. But where does she actually spend it? Because Tennessee is an incredibly geographically diverse state. You can't just broadcast a single message and expect it to land the same way in the Smoky Mountains as it does in downtown Memphis.
You really can't. The state essentially operates as three distinct political ecosystems.
Break that down for us.
Sure. East Tennessee, which includes Knoxville, Chattanooga, and the Tri-Cities, is the state's deep red margin engine. This is the durable Republican reservoir. To win a statewide landslide as a conservative, you need overwhelming 70%+ margins from these Appalachian and rural counties.
Okay, and then you move to Middle Tennessee, anchored by Nashville.
Right. Now, Davidson County itself, Nashville, is a Democratic anchor. But the ring of counties around it, places like Williamson, Rutherford, and Sumner counties, these are fast-growing suburban and exurban battlegrounds.
And growth means change.
Exactly. The population in Rutherford County alone is estimated to be up 13.1% since 2020. And notably, this is the region where John Rose showed real primary strength, actually carrying several of those Middle Tennessee counties. It's a very volatile area.
And finally, we have West Tennessee, which is anchored by Memphis in Shelby County. This is a massive Democratic stronghold. And importantly, it is the home turf of the Democratic nominee, Jerry Green.
Yes. Jerry Green dominated her primary, winning 69% of the vote. And her campaign strategy is structurally very different from Blackburn's. She is engaging in classic retail politics.
Let's define that for the listener in this context. What does retail politics look like here?
Retail politics means hyperlocal, face-to-face voter interaction, handshaking, town halls, neighborhood organizing. She's relying on dense urban organizing in Memphis and Nashville, but she's also executing a massive amount of statewide travel to rural areas to avoid being boxed in as just a Memphis candidate.
Right. She has to introduce herself to the rest of the state. And when you look at their platforms, again, neutrally reporting what the source material lays out here, the contrast is staggering.
It's night and day.
Green is focusing her campaign on local, tangible issues, affordability, fully funding public schools, expanding Medicaid, protecting reproductive rights, and a day one plan to end state highway patrol cooperation with federal ICE enforcement.
It's a platform deeply tailored to energize urban centers and appeal directly to moderate suburbanites who might be concerned about the mechanics of public services.
Meanwhile, Blackburn is taking her federal brand and essentially promising a Trump-era executive model at the state level. She's promising a complete ban on Chinese entities owning any type of land in Tennessee. She wants a bell-to-bell, no-cell policy banning phones in classrooms. She's pushing tax cuts, deregulation, and explicit state cooperation with Trump's deportation enforcement.
Right.
But wait, why is a candidate for state governor talking about Chinese land ownership? That sounds like a federal wedge issue.
Because it is. She's taking national, highly emotional issues, fights over China, big tech, the border, and reinterpreting them as state-level administrative actions. It's designed to mobilize a base that consumes national political media.
Okay, but this brings up a massive strategic contradiction in a report regarding how she is spending her money.
Like Memphis ad.
Yes. If Memphis and Shelby County are absolute Democratic strongholds, I mean, Democrats won it by roughly 25 points in 2024. Why did Blackburn run an official July 30th TV ad explicitly targeting Memphis public safety? Wait, let me guess. Is she actually trying to persuade Democrats to vote for her, or is this just about riling up her own base in the suburbs so they don't stay home?
You hit the nail on the head. It's a concept called margin management.
Margin management.
Right. Blackburn isn't under any illusion that she is going to flip Shelby County red. That's not the objective. The objective is arithmetic. Shelby County has a massive urban Democratic core, but it also has a significant population of suburban Republicans. By hammering a message on crime, law enforcement, and public safety, she's trying to accomplish two things at once.
Okay, what's the first?
First, maximize the turnout of those suburban Republicans who might otherwise feel like their vote doesn't matter in a heavy blue county.
Ah, you have to give them a local, visceral reason to actually show up at the polls.
Exactly. And second, she is trying to limit the overall margin of the Democratic victory in that specific county. Let's look at the math. If a Democrat wins Shelby County by 80,000 votes, that's a massive hole for the Republican to dig out of statewide.
Right.
But if Blackburn's ads drive enough suburban turnout to limit that loss to only 60,000 votes, that is a net gain of 20,000 votes for her statewide total.
Wow. So you don't have to win the battle to win the war. You just have to make sure you don't lose the battle too badly. You limit the bleeding in the cities, so your massive margins in East Tennessee can completely overwhelm the final statewide total.
It is an arithmetic strategy purely designed to manage the statewide margins.
So we've gone super deep into the weeds of Tennessee County math, but what does this all mean for the rest of the country? Like, if you were listening to this in New York or Texas or California, why should you care about the granular mechanics of this specific governor's race?
Well, first of all, history is going to be made regardless of the outcome. Come November 3, Tennessee is going to elect its first female governor, whether it's Marsha Blackburn, who is already the state's first female U.S. senator, or Jerry Green. A historic milestone is going to be set.
That's huge. But the ripple effect of this race goes way beyond the state border, doesn't it? It actually dictates the balance of power in Washington.
It absolutely does. This raises an important question about federal power. If Marsha Blackburn wins the governorship in November, she cannot hold two offices. She has to vacate her U.S. Senate seat in January 2027. And her current Senate term doesn't naturally expire until January 2031.
So what happens to the seat? Does it just sit empty?
No. Under Tennessee law, the new governor gets to make an interim appointment to fill that Senate vacancy. And then it triggers a high-stakes special election for the remainder of the term, which would happen in 2028.
Wait, really? So one state-level executive race suddenly creates a massive ripple effect that alters the makeup of the U.S. Senate?
Yes.
It turns a locked-in 6-year Senate seat into an appointed wild card, followed by a nationalized special election right in the middle of the next presidential cycle. The entire national political apparatus will have to divert resources to Tennessee in 2028 if she wins.
Exactly. The political machinery of a single state race directly impacts the federal calculus for both parties across the country.
That is wild. Let's briefly recap the incredible mechanics we've covered today because it really changes how you look at the news.
It really does.
We looked at how a powerful incumbent survived a fractured plurality primary where 56% of her base wanted someone else. We saw the sheer strategic brilliance of strategic ambiguity timing a Trump endorsement to bridge the gap between primary survival and general election
The
consolidation.
timing was everything.
We navigated the legal labyrinth of a $4.8 million Paixi money maze that lets a candidate keep their hands clean while independent groups throw the mud. And we examined the arithmetic of margin management spending millions to fight in blue counties just to keep the margins down.
It really is a masterclass in the unromantic, deeply mathematical realities of running for high office. It's all spreadsheets and legal firewalls.
It is.
Yeah.
But I want to leave you, the listener, with one final unexamined thread from this source material to ponder. Something that throws a bit of a wild card into all this careful mathematical planning.
The independent candidates.
Yes. The report notes that there are 13 independent candidates who have qualified for the November ballot. Now, usually independents don't make much noise in a statewide race, they get a fraction of a percent.
All right, they're usually just a footnote.
But one of them, a candidate named Lauren Pinkston, has independently raised over $342,000.
Which is a highly non-trivial amount of money for an independent in a state race. It shows a level of organizational capacity that you just don't usually see outside the major parties.
Right. Now, combine that with two facts we discussed earlier. First, a massive 56.4% of Republican primary voters chose not to vote for Marsha Blackburn. They were actively looking for an alternative.
Very true.
Second, midterm electorates are notoriously unpredictable because they rely on enthusiasm and habitual voting, which is much harder to model than a presidential year. So, in a highly polarized environment where the base might be deeply fractured and the electorate is volatile, consider this. Could a well-funded, long-shot independent candidate act as a spoiler?
Oh, wow.
Could someone like Pinkston absorb enough of those angry protest votes from a fractured primary to actually tip the arithmetic of those tightly managed county margins we just talked about?
It's exactly the kind of variable that keeps campaign managers awake at night. You can build the perfect financial and geographic blueprint, but you can't always account for human volatility in the voting booth.
You really can't. The math is only as solid as the people casting the ballots. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We hope this gave you a new lens to look at the campaigns happening in your own backyard. Keep analyzing the media, keep questioning the political machinery around you, and we'll see you next time.